the interview with Eldon Mills on the 25th, we decided, June 25th.
Yeah. That was a major windfall for the city, believe it or not, because the city got all that land.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the land where the park and ride is now, you know, between Baseline and Washington. All that land west of Adams to Dennis. And then there was some land on the west side of Dennis that also came in that trade, or came in that transaction. So the city traded that land to Copeland Lumber for the land where Copeland Lumber had was right across the street from the old city hall, and the city made a parking lot into that one.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a whole bunch of land trades went on there, all beneficial to the city. And I suppose General Foods made something out of their significant contributions too.
Yeah, well, they, like you said, they got the tax write-off.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
They sent an executive vice president out from White Plains to sit down with us and do the final stuff. And it was very, I was really pleased with that one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to pause here for just a moment. Okay, well, you know, another topic that I know was really important throughout the valley here was something you alluded to earlier, the poor quality of many of the sewer districts, the one Hillsborough plan included, of course, which I guess all came to a head in the early 70s. But before we talk about that, can you tell me what you actually observed in the river at that time when things were pretty bad in terms of the outfalls? I mean, you said that the river, you know, flow was really diminished in the summertime, but were there other signs of distress as well?
Well, sure. There wasn't any in the first place. There wasn't any water in it, and what was in it was being put in by those various sewage treatment plants and being pumped out 400 yards downstream by some farmer that didn't have any right to it. So the summertime, the water was the river was. Well, it was just an absolute mess, whatever there was, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, when the state finally cracked down, I guess, mm-hmm. it was, what, in 1971?
I think it was 71, yeah.
When they said, well, they essentially...
They put a building ban on the county.
Right, and I believe they, to some extent, dictated the solution, too, didn't they? They wanted to see a single entity out
Well,
there.
That's what they wanted. They didn't get it, but that's what they wanted.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, can you tell me where you were then when you heard about the building moratorium? That must have put a bit of a monkey wrench in your plans too, in terms of the development.
Yeah, I heard about 11:30 in the morning, and that at 5 o'clock that day we were to stop issuing building permits, which we did. But we took a look at, here we're sitting with a brand new, basically a brand new treatment plant, and we got a brand new operating permit on that Rock Creek plant that they had just issued a couple months before. Maybe I'm wrong on a couple months, but a short time before. And we said, this is just not right. So the next meeting of the commission was in Bend. So we filed to make a presentation for the commission in Bend. So we drove over and made our presentation. They then released the part of Hillsborough that was going into that plant for building permits and left the rest of the county frozen.
Uh-huh.
Well, God, you can see what happened to us. All of a sudden, we got all the building in the whole damn county.
Mm-hmm.
Then they started putting together the idea of the USA. Well, it became abundantly clear, just like the freckles on your nose, that if we became a part of USA, we were going to get back into that ban. Because it was going to take them a long time to put together not only a plan, but to build some facilities. So we said, no, we'll go it alone. The rest of you go to USA. So everybody bought off on that. So we kept our bonds. They were responsible for their debt. And then when it, further down the road, I don't know, 10 or 12 years down the road, maybe longer than that, I guess, when it became, you know, they were up and running, it became apparent to me, it became apparent to us, I should say, I guess, as the council and my staff, that it now made sense to make overtures toward joining USA. So we negotiated a deal with USA, which basically says, we will keep the bonds that we have to here, and you pay the bonds that you have to there. Now, we will join you, we'll become a part of the agency under these various conditions, you know. You set the rates, and we'll collect the money, and we'll give you a percentage of the money that we collect. Much the same as the other cities did. I think there were a few minor changes in it, but USA was very anxious to get us under the one umbrella, and it made very good financial sense to us as well as technical sense. So we became a part of USA. Mm-hmm. But many years later than they had hoped we were going to.
Mm-hmm. And originally the main reason was that you wanted to avoid the moratorium, being subject to the
moratorium. We were the ones that had spent the money to build the plant, you know, and this plant was being held up by people in the EQC as this is what everybody needs to do. We had done it. Mm-hmm. It's up and running. Like I told you, Jim Burns was out there drinking water out of the outfall line, you know. It didn't make any sense for them to give us an operating permit and then include us in the ban. Mm-hmm. But it did make sense for them to probably to include the old plant in the ban. Mm-hmm. Because we were in the process of getting it up, but it wasn't up yet, you know. So.
And so did the moratorium add urgency to that project then, to getting the new the old plant up to snuff?
No.
You were already well
into that? We were probably at some stage of design, I can't remember. Rarely in my career did I add urgency to something, because somebody always told me if you hurry up with something, you're going to miss too much. So you're better off staying with your carefully laid out plan and doing it right and not trying to cut the corners.
Mm-hmm. So that meant that you did have the building moratorium in effect for part of the city?
Yeah, the west side. The west side. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any building going on the west side to speak of anyway.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this area out in here was all going to the east side. Mm-hmm. Because this area was built later than that quite a bit, but this was built like 7-8 years after that ban.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were, I don't even remember how many, but there were a lot of little sewerage districts that were impacted by this.
Don't remember either. And Kramer should have told you, he knew.
Yeah, I think I did hear from him, you know, who they all were. But if I remember correctly from what Gary told me, that the idea that all of these individual plants would have to give up their own little turf and merge into one agency wasn't something that went down real easily at
probably
first.
Not, but I wasn't involved in that since I kept the city out of that, you know, probably not.
Uh-huh.
But there was Fano Creek, and there was, I don't know all of them, you know. But,
well, what I'm curious about is that with Hillsborough setting the example of being able to kind of opt out of this, whether others, you know, maybe attempted to follow your lead. In particular, I'm wondering why Gary Kramer, who at that time was the head of the Alloa Sanitary District, and I think had just...
His operating permit wouldn't meet DEQ guideline.
But he had, wasn't his plant also fairly newly constructed?
I don't remember whether it was or not. I don't remember whether it was or not.
But that was the critical, that was the litmus test then, was whether the...
So that's just my opinion. Like I said, I wasn't involved in that because we said, you know, we told the commission, we're out of this thing, you know, leave us out of this thing. And they did, you know, like 2 weeks later, one of their guys sent us a letter and said, you're permitted to issue building permits on anything going into the Rock Creek plant.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you also mentioned that you did opt to get into USA later. And what was that negotiation? Was that fairly smooth?
Very good, yeah.
Yeah.
They were anxious to get us. And it, you know, and it made good sense. It made economic sense. It made political sense. And we were ready to go in. And so it was just a matter of seeing who could get a little bit edge on the other guy in negotiating it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And nobody, and you know, everybody walks away and thinks they're a winner. That's good. If everybody walks away and thinks they're a loser, that may be better.
Another issue that, I think has been there all along, and it certainly surfaced, I think, in the mid-80s when the lawsuits were filed, but it's the issue of various communities sort of competing with one another or pointing the finger at, you know, somebody else in terms of, you know, where their problems are coming from. I mean, the one that I'm thinking of in connection with the lawsuit was Lake Oswego complaining about, you know, the quality of water that was coming down the Tualatin at that time, and the fact that they were having, you know, problems with algae growth in the lake and other things. I'm just wondering if you had much to do with any of these squabbles.
Nope.
Yeah.
I was a part of USA and let USA handle all that.
Uh huh.
Sat back and rubbed my hands in glee and said, "God, I'm glad I'm not in there."
Do you have any thoughts, or did you observe anything that was particularly interesting as far as these kinds of struggles went on?
No.
That went on.
I don't remember it well enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about when they?
I think that I guess I always did feel that the Tualatin was a bad river. No question about it. But had it flowed through Portland, and Portland had been responsible for the damn thing instead of USA, those things would never have happened. Because Portland's still not meeting anything.
So this is a comment on the way things work in terms of your political clout.
You're damn right. Mm-hmm. You're damn right. All the political clout in Oregon sits right there in Portland. You know that, and I know that. Yeah, it's getting worse.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess half of the state's population lives in the Portland area anyway. I suppose by analogy that if you confine yourself to looking at I guess Portland would still have clout out here too, but Hillsborough must be a major player in Washington County.
Yeah, I'd say that they are a major player. But they play very well with Washington County and I think with the other cities. Mm-hmm. That might not have always been the case, but I think it is now. Because, you know, like they're tied together now in so many ways. I mean, they're on the same, you know, they're on the same team with such things as light rail issues. They're on the same team with a lot of the transportation issues. So they're on the same team with sanitary sewer issues. And then the cities are all on the same team, again, with USA on some of this water stuff. See, so, and some of the cities are tied together with Rural Fire Protection District number 1. And maybe, depending on who gets the award of the contract for ambulance services, maybe Hillsborough's going to be tied in with them too, you know. So there's a lot of commingling of governmental entities. In the first place, there are too many governmental entities in the metropolitan area. I started a study when I was at the Bureau of Governmental Research back in 61 about the various governmental entities in the Portland metropolitan statistical area. And I've forgotten how many it was. It was just mind-boggling, and there's still probably almost as many of them left as there were. I don't know why people won't give those damn things up. You know, there's cemetery districts, there's drainage districts, there's all sorts of districts out there. Mm-hmm. Most of them have very little function.
Mm-hmm. What about organizations such as Metro that you know sort of attempt to?
Well, you can just spoil my day when you talk about Metro.
Yeah.
I have nothing good to think about Metro, nothing good to say about Metro. So. Yeah. I don't.
So you don't think they've been very effective?
I don't think that Metro is worth the powder take to blow them to hell.
And why is that?
Well, I don't think, in the first place, I don't think that that Metro is a necessary entity. We got Metro on one side, we got TriMet on the other side. Of course, Metro has the authority to take over TriMet, too. By a stroke of a pen, in case you're not aware of that. Everything that Metro has assumed authority, I mean, the people have given them the authority. Right or wrong, they have the authority. Could have been done with existing governments had they had the sense to work together. It's just like this regional water plan. I don't know whether you're up to date on it or not, but all the water players, all the water purveyors in the plan have joined this regional water plan to come up with water for year 2050, 2040, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
A consortium such as that could have done the same thing that Metro is doing and not cost any money. You have any idea what the hell Metro costs? I don't know, but it's pretty spendy.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy writing that check to Metro every year.
So your approach would be something more along the lines of the 2040 consortium then?
I think it's done a good job on evaluating the water issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gone from everybody, from the very smallest to the very largest, which is the Portland Water Bureau. And the same thing. You know, what has Metro done? You tell me. Well, they've broken up set out some open space. Big goddamn deal. Every community can be required by one stroke of the legislature pen to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to spend the kind of money that they elected to spend it on. That's enough of that.
So it's just an inefficient way to accomplish the task then, in terms of money anyway, huh?
It may turn into something someday worthwhile, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone through the CRAG, you know what CRAG was? Columbia Region Associates of Government, which involved all the governments on this side of the river, as well as the ones over and across the river in Vancouver. We messed with that for I don't know how many years. It didn't work either.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure TriMet's going to work. I'm not even sure this light rail thing is. I got an open mind on it, but I'm not sure it's going to solve much. It damn well better solve something for the amount of money that's going into it. Do you think it's going to solve anything?
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Would you, as a businessman, put that kind of money into something that you weren't convinced was going to solve something? Hell no, you wouldn't.
I imagine it is going to more closely tie some of the areas out here to the city, and that there'll probably be a fair amount of development along the corridor.
Sure. Sure. The question is, those people that are going to live in that development going to take the light rail? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at an area right out here, just, you know, not very far out, maybe a mile out. They're going to build all this high-rise stuff right up next to the light rail, and, you know, covered walkways to get to the stop and all that stuff. But there isn't any incentive if you want to drive your damn car and put up the traffic. There isn't any incentive to put you on the rail. Now, there may be someday. there may be. They may, you know, they may put some kind of a tax on you that makes you not want to drive your car. Or they may put some kind of an incentive on you that you get some kind of a rebate for riding light rail. But the way it's set up now, I don't understand that it would do that.
Yeah, although with the traffic you sometimes encounter, especially during rush hour, getting from here to Portland or back.
How long do you think it's going to take to get from here to Portland on light rail?
Well, I assume it would be quicker than the traffic.
It might be quicker at some times of the day, but it's going to be the majority of an hour.
Yeah, it's that bad, huh?
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know either.
It's got a bunch of stops, and it goes down through Beaverton, you know, and it's got a bunch of stops. And now, I like the transit system in, like, Toronto. I think that's a neat transit system. It's kind of a radial. It's kind of like the spokes of a wheel without the rim on it, you know. Mm-hmm. Runs out like that. And you can get on over here and run down here and jump on another car and go out there. In just, 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. But you don't think Metro is going to be that efficient in terms of...
I don't know. Maybe it is. See, I shouldn't be talking about it because I've never even ridden the one out to Gresham. Have you?
No, I haven't either. I've ridden it from around downtown or in closer in. And it's not terribly fast there. You're yeah. right about that, because there's so many stops.
But it might be fun, you know. It'd be fun for people like me. If I need to go downtown, I got plenty of time to leave early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, it's proven to be, light rail has proven to be fairly efficient in some major,
But not in Washington, D.C. See, a very good friend of mine was the general manager of the Council of Governments in Washington, D.C. And when they were starting to put that thing together 20 plus years ago under the streets and all that, they came to the COG and said, we're going to need, I don't know, they said $10 million a year or $20 million a year for 10 years as a subsidy for this thing. So the COG said, okay, no problem. The second year they wanted $120 million, I think is what he said, not 20. I don't know where it is now. Walter's retired, so I don't know where it is. But I'll bet the COG or somebody subsidized the hell out of it.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know how I should get around Washington, D.C. either. If I have to go to Washington, D.C., I land at National and get on that thing and go downtown. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why, as a matter of fact, I was thinking of Washington when I said that it works well from, at least from a rider's point of view.
You can
get on it and get around fairly easily. Well, there's one, other subject that we should talk a little bit about is the lawsuit that came along in the middle 80s.
I really don't know anything about it.
Yeah?
I really don't.
Oh, you said you knew Jack Churchill, so you must...
I know, I've known Jack, not very well, but I've known him for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware of him in particular in connection with the lawsuit?
Only what I read in the paper.
Yeah. But USA, though, I guess it didn't have much to do with the city of Hillsborough, per se, but it was, it's an entity that reports to the Washington County Commissioners. I assumed that, that it must have had some impact on the county in terms of the potential damages.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. But I don't recall that there were some memos put out by probably Kramer's office. It's kind of a status reports on that thing from time to time, but that's all I kind of vaguely remember.
Mm-hmm. What about the, you said when that you finally opted to get into USA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that something you thought that the city would do originally when you opted out of USA? Or was that more a reflection of the fact that you saw what USA had become and thought that they were... an okay organization to get involved with?
God, Michael, I'm not sure. I can't remember that I had that thought that we would join or wouldn't join. I suspect that it was one of those wait and see and let them prove themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't lose. I mean, it's one of those situations you can't lose. You can continue to build. You can stay on the outside. And maybe they'll want to take you in someday. And they made gestures at us time after time after time. It was when the timing was right that we said, okay, we'll go.
And you've been, it sounds like you're pretty good friends with Gary Kramer.
Oh, well, Gary and I have been good friends for years. We came here about the same time in about 61. He went to work out at the sewage treatment plant. I went to work downtown. Yeah, Gary and I go fishing and stuff all the time. We've probably been fishing 7 or 8 times already this year. Matter of fact, we co-chair the Economic Development Committee for the Chamber of Commerce. And after the meeting tomorrow, we're going to, I think we're going to go together to a poker session.
Oh, yeah? I'm a bit of a poker player myself.
Are you?
Yeah.
Good. Where do you get to play? Where do you play? Oh, I guess there's some place over in Vancouver that you can play in there.
Well, I play in a private game.
Private games?
Yeah, we meet once a month. It's a small, fairly small stakes, table stakes game, and we play mostly straight poker.
Play what?
Straight poker, as opposed to any.
I sometimes go up to the center.
Yeah.
Have you ever played up there?
No, I haven't.
They play hold'em up there.
Yeah.
I've never gone to either one of the relatively new Indian casinos, but...
Yeah, nor have I.
I stopped in one on Monday and watched him play blackjack, and I played 3 hands and won $40 and quit.
Uh-huh. Well, it's probably the best strategy.
Yeah, because I can't play blackjack. I never could play blackjack, still can't.
Yeah. Well, back to Gary Kramer for just a minute. One of the things that, when you saw the lawsuit come down, well, actually not Gary Kramer, I remember what it was I was going to ask you. It was about the development angle. The lawsuit, of course, was brought by Churchill and Jack Smith and some of the others over the issue of meeting the Clean Water Act standards, and it was particularly phosphorus that they wanted USA to address, and there was some question as to whether they could, and so forth and so on. But I'm just wondering if now that USA has successfully risen to the challenge and met, the requirements of the lawsuit, or at least almost met them, do you think that it was overall a good thing that they went down that road, or do you think that it didn't make any difference?
Well, I think that the state should have been the ones that forced USA to meet them. I don't know. It had to be done. But it has to be done with all the other substandard rivers too. Damn it. You know, I flew over the Tualatin Valley not very long ago, and up above Gaston, between Gaston and Cherry Grove, there's a major dairy operation up there. He had gigantic mounds of manure from his dairy operation piled all over his fields. I mean, gigantic mounds, like, bigger than this room. And I don't know how many of them were out there. Let's say 12 to 20 of them. It was raining like hell. Now, there's a major difference between point and non-point pollution. But as long as that kind of thing can exist where this runoff is going to get in the river, you're never going to have a pristine river. You know, we're required now in the logging operation, we're required to stay 50 feet from the stream. Well, if you get any kind of runoff at all, that 50 feet is just going to be a little bit of a barrier. You're still going to get dirt and silt and everything else running through there, you know.
So you're saying that...
I'm saying the farming operations are going to have to be cleaned up, too.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are out there putting all kinds of chemicals on the ground. They're out there with those big guns pouring the water on the ground, and it's running off in the goddamn river. Mm-hmm. We take water samples, I don't know how many times a day, there at the treatment plant. A lot of this stuff occurs above that treatment plant. Well, we can treat it out, you know. We can get it out. That's not the problem. There's a lot of it goes in below there. And the stuff that goes on by has already got it in there. You can't just clean up the treatment plants and consequently clean up the river. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet you that there's still... I can't bet you because I don't know how to prove it. But I predict that there are still an awful lot of illegal users pumping out of that river. Right today. Mm-hmm. Watermaster, I'm sure, does his damnedest. But it used to be those guys were pretty ingenious about how to run pipes out under the ground, you know, and get into the river and, I don't know, pump at night and however, I don't know how they did it. But. And if you have land and don't have any water rights, you know you can't grow much of anything here in the summer months.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the ag community is the worst?
I think the ag community is next that has to be looked at.
Mm-hmm. It's the next highest priority after the...
I think that they can solve as much of their problem as USA could solve of its problem. Mm-hmm. But you're still not going to turn that Tualatin River into a pristine stream. In the first place, it probably never was. They talk about the steamboats that used to come up to Hillsborough. Some of those channels, that must have been a very narrow steamboat, but I suppose they've caved in or whatever. But I doubt that it was ever really a pristine stream because it's so flat and it's so slow. Mm-hmm. If you had some riffles in it, if you had some falls in it, where you're going to get some oxygenation in the water and stuff like that, which will add back to the quality of the water, might make some sense to me. But it's a good old crawdad pond is what it really is. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be the kind of schlock it used to be. And it isn't. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's not in good shape. Because the floods in February filled Scoggins Dam with a kind of a sedimentation. Well, it's not a sedimentation. Filled it with a material that just won't settle out. So the turbidity levels coming out of the dam are just extremely high. And they're going all the way through. Mm-hmm. There's no way to get it out.
So do you see it in your drinking water then?
Or? No. The guys peel it out. I mean, but they have a lot more. They have a lot more solids to dispose of in their drying beds. No, you can't sit and drink water. But at this time of the year, you normally get 2 to maybe 5 units of turbidity. I don't know what they're getting now, but the stuff coming out of the dam a couple of weeks ago was 130. Uh-huh. And I talked to a lady who was up there fishing from the bank. I said, how far could you see your bait in the water? And she said, about a foot. So the water master told Carl Borg, who runs the water treatment plant, back in April, that it probably wouldn't settle out this whole year.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean...
But it's just dirt.
Right.
Yeah. It's just soil that's... They had some major washes. Tim Herbert told me that he was on this tour a couple of weeks ago, and they had some major washouts up above the dam on some of the streams, you know. And there's still a raw bank there that the water's running by and picking that stuff up. Well, you could solve that, you know. It's a lot of money. You can go in there and build a rock gabion, you know, and close that off. But it's just money. Mm-hmm. Well, the irrigators don't have any interest in it. the M&I people can treat it out, so just run it down the river, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What about the money that's been spent so far improving the water quality and the toilet? Do you think it's been a good investment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the fact that building permits are more expensive now, sewage interconnect permits, et cetera.
I've always been a believer, I've always been a believer in the user pay. And so if you're hooking onto my system and it cost me, as a bureaucrat, it cost me $6,000 to develop the capacity for you to hook onto my system, then you got to pay the $6,000. Mm-hmm. Or you go build someplace else. I've always believed that, Clinsburg is probably the only community around, it might not be true now, but for years it was the only community around that had a depreciation amortization fund, both water and sewer. Because we not only figured what it costs to hook you on, but what it costs to maintain it. And that's what we charged you. And we took those charges and put them in that DNA fund. So that when we had to replace that pipeline someplace down the road, you had a couple of pennies in there along with everybody else. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to go back to the people and ask for a bond issue to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then, well, maybe just as a way of concluding here, besides the ag community, what other issues do you think are going to come to the forefront here with respect to?
Well, I think they've solved the problem with the nursery people. Mm-hmm. That was one that some time ago I had some questions about. But now they have to have complete recirculation systems. So I think they've solved that one.
And that was the fertilizer?
Yeah, the stuff that they spray on their plants, they had to put in underground drainage and pick it up and reuse it. Mm-hmm. Can't release it into a receiving stream.
And was that do you think that was a big impact on the river originally, or?
I don't know. It was just one of those things you think about. Mm-hmm. Before they started having to do it the way they're doing it now, And besides the guys that have done it, I guess they've all done it, but they say it's a lot cheaper now that they have the systems in, because whatever runs off the first time is still in the water, and they pick it up and they get to reuse it, Like the fertilizers, the pesticides, and whatever. They get to reuse it, just add some more to it, and put it back out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anything else. I don't know. If you had... logging can create turbidity. Road building can create turbidity. And let me tell you something that creates turbidity any place there's water running is recreational vehicles. You turn a bunch of people loose with RVs, I'm talking about dirt bikes and four-wheelers and stuff like that, where there aren't roads built for them, turn them loose in the woods someplace. They'll create ruts, that water will run down ruts and pick up dirt and wind up in a receiving stream. I can show you washouts on sides of some of the mountains that you wouldn't believe. All started because somebody went up when it was muddy with a dirt bike or some kind of an ATV, Created a rut, started the water running down. The deeper the rut, the more water ran down it, and pretty soon you got a whole damn arroyo developed, Mm-hmm. Yeah. They really irritate the hell out of me. I have no problem with them staying on the roads, but when they start striking off cross country through the timber, they are a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Although I've always thought about it more in terms of their impact on the the wildlife in the woods and the solitude in the woods for that
matter. Yeah, I don't know that they bother the wildlife so awful much. The other morning I was going to the project and I came around a bend, there was a cow elk standing in the road. And she just stood there, and I drove up to within about, I suppose, 75 or 80 feet of her, and she just stood there and looked at me. And so I stopped, and Tim Weber was with me, and we looked down below the road, and there were seven or eight of them right there. You know, you could have backhanded a rock to any of them. And I said, well, she's not going to stand here forever. And I started up, and she stood there, till, I suppose I was 50 feet from her, and she walked out of the road and let me go by. But the vehicle didn't bother him a bit.
Okay, Alden. Well, I think I'm running out of questions here, at least for right now. Unless you can think something else. Have we overlooked any major topics here?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.